We shared their disappointments and delights, and rejoiced in their marriages and children. These were some of the happiest and most hopeful times of my life. During those years, I was not able to see my family in the United States very much. The first purely personal trip I took to the United States was in 1987, almost 10 years after our marriage. For all that time, I had felt I could not in good conscience leave my husband and small children at home, not to mention my other increasingly demanding responsibilities as queen. However, just days short of her 100th birthday, my grandmother died. My father had been planning a surprise family reunion and birthday party, which instead turned into a memorial celebration of her life in my father's garden in Washington, D.C. Although the occasion was sad, it gave my children a chance to visit with, and in some cases meet for the first time, their American cousins. That private time in America, without the pressure of speeches, press interviews, or anything political whatsoever, allowed me to realize how much I missed family and friends. I needed to find time for them. Otherwise, I would lose touch with my roots and the influences that had shaped my life. In this spirit, I decided to stay on for a few days after my grandmother's memorial service to attend the wedding of one of my Concord Academy classmates, Julia Preston. I had to negotiate intently with the U.S. Secret Service during that week to scale down their arrangements. I would not have gone to the wedding if I thought I would ruin it by being surrounded and creating a distraction. In the end, the head of the security detail made extraordinary efforts to allow me to blend unobtrusively into the wedding party. There was no prior announcement that I was attending, and I arrived quietly and left the same way. Best of all, no one except my close friends knew who I was. It was a wonderful feeling just to be myself, not on display, with old friends. From then on, I made a concerted effort to invite friends to various official and private events in America. In England, I made contact with Carinthia West, my classmate from the National Cathedral School in Washington, whom I had not seen in a decade. Carinthia was somewhat startled when I called out of the blue, and she was told by the woman who answered the phone that the Queen of Norway was calling. After we cleared up the garbled message, I invited Carinthia to Jordan. Over the years to come, other friends would visit, and my husband and I would enjoy sharing our Jordanian friends and the rich culture and history of the country with them. For my 40th birthday, a group of my old friends from Concord Academy camped at Wadi Rum. Raya shared a tent with my friend Julia, whose own daughter, around Raya's age, had not been able to attend. Jordan and the region were slipping into recession in the late 1980s as the oil boom ended. Those Arab countries that had been flush with oil revenues in the 1970s were experiencing a downturn, and the aid they had pledged to Jordan slowed to a trickle. The salaries of Jordanians working abroad were either frozen or reduced, and the remittances they sent home began to dwindle. New employment opportunities for Jordanians abroad were curtailed, and the unemployment rate in Jordan rose sharply, especially among university graduates who would have been in great demand during better times. There was a growing sense of discontent in the country. In the fall of 1987, Hussein and I made a state visit to Finland. The Finns were incredibly welcoming, lining the streets to wave wherever we went, and extending extraordinarily enthusiastic hospitality at every level. Perhaps it was because the king was the first Arab head of state to visit Finland in a decade. Or perhaps Hussein was seen as a peacemaker from a region where Finnish peacekeeping forces had been stationed since the early 1970s. Whatever the reason for their fulsome embrace, it was quite overwhelming. In no uncertain terms, President Mauno Koivisto reiterated Finland's support for a settlement of the Arab-Israeli conflict based on the UN resolutions, and called on Iran to accept a UN-sponsored peace plan to end the bloody conflict with Iraq. And Jordan, reached its first tourism agreement with Finland. Once a week from then on, a Royal Jordanian flight would arrive in Aqaba full of Scandinavian tourists from Helsinki, bringing a welcome boost to our economy. It was a phenomenon we had witnessed before. Wherever we traveled, there would be a resulting upsurge in tourism to Jordan from the host country. To our surprise, this trip also provoked very pointed criticism. Because of Finland's extremely formal protocol, we had been required to wear the most formal state regalia, including decorations, and, in my case, a tiara. The press photos of us triggered the reaction back home that we were out of touch with Jordanian reality, a view that underscored the discontent and disaffection that was building as the economy worsened. This was, after all, normal state protocol during a visit that would bring significant economic and political benefits to Jordan. Throughout 1987, the King continued to press for an international conference with the PLO and all five permanent members of the Security Council. In July, he met secretly with Israel's new right-wing Prime Minister, Yitzhak Shamir, at Castlewood outside London to see if there was any hope of making headway with Israel. The meeting was inconclusive. Hussein told me later that the atmosphere at Castlewood had been very tense. Shamir's staff was so suspicious that they wanted to search Hussein's secretary's bags and to examine the food. The Israelis would not even use the house phone. They went into the nearby village to make their phone calls from a public phone booth. George Shultz, the U.S. Secretary of State, picked up where Shamir left off, and on October 20 visited my husband at our house in London, Palace Green. The U.S. proposal to the King was consistent, virtually word for word, with the Israeli position. Forget any international conference and negotiate directly with Shamir without the PLO or the permanent members of the UN Security Council. The King said he could not oblige. After the U.S. delegation left and we were tidying up the sitting room, we found the briefing notes of one of Shultz's aides behind a cushion on the couch. Marked Strategies for Dealing with Hussein, it was a point-by-point blueprint for dealing with my husband. Within minutes, a U.S. diplomat rang the doorbell urgently, explaining that the Americans had overlooked some papers on their departure. He recovered the notes in the cushions, where we had returned them after we had made our own copies. Israel so dominated the U.S. position that there was no negotiating room left for the Arabs. The Arab countries, however, were more unified than ever. In fact, Jordan hosted an Arab summit in Amman in November 1987 and achieved the impossible. 8 months before the conference, the King had invited two arch-enemies, Hafez al-Assad of Syria, who was supporting Iran in the Iran-Iraq war, and Saddam Hussein of Iraq, to make up their differences, and they had. Now, at the conference, the two men talked for 13 hours on the first day and 7 hours on the next. The two enemies emerged, if not friends, at least agreeing not to attack each other publicly. Both, miraculously, came to the unity summit in Amman, as did the Egyptian leader Hosni Mubarak, for Egypt's first Arab summit since Camp David. My husband's ceaseless struggle to promote unity in the Middle East was beginning to bear fruit. The summit was, in fact, one of my husband's finest hours. For once, the Arab countries spoke with one voice, with even Hafez al-Assad accepting my husband's call for unity by joining the others in announcing solidarity with Iraq. Arafat was also well received. Indeed, Jordan and the PLO formally restored relations soon after the summit ended. Saddam Hussein, who almost never left his country, was so worried about his security that he would not stay, as planned, at the Iraqi ambassador's residence. At the last minute, we had to ask six families living in a family compound in Amman to move to a hotel so we could house the Iraqi president and his huge entourage, most of them members of his personal guard. Throughout his stay in Amman, Saddam Hussein would eat only food prepared by his own staff. The unexpected ripple effect of the Amman summit led to a pivotal moment in the Middle East. The Palestinians in the occupied territories launched a series of demonstrations against Israeli occupation that reflected a growing cohesion between the Palestinian leadership functioning outside the occupied territories and its constituents inside, as well as a mounting desperation. After the past 10 years of agonizing stalemate, I could not help but hope that these voices of protest might be heard. The Israelis responded in full force to the demonstrations, but went too far in December, a month after the Amman summit, when settlers shot and killed a Palestinian schoolgirl, and Israeli authorities demanded that her parents bury her at night without a proper funeral. That inexcusable incident, followed by the seemingly intentional crash of an Israeli army vehicle into a line of traffic, killing 4 Palestinians, provoked outrage in Gaza and the West Bank. 2 days later, the 1987 Intifada, or uprising, began. The international media descended on Israel and the occupied territories, sending nightly images of boys in jeans and T-shirts throwing stones at Israeli soldiers in full riot gear, who responded with tear gas, beatings, and gunfire. The David and Goliath parallel was unmistakable, and for the first time put the human face of the Palestinian tragedy on the front pages of newspapers worldwide and in the television news. Israel insisted the coverage was biased and anti-Semitic, but there was no mistaking the brutality of the images and the rising body count, which over the course of the next 4 years would reach 1,300 Palestinians and 80 Israelis. Even the Reagan administration took note, leading to a very curious telephone conversation between my husband and the U.S. president in January 1988. The king had become increasingly aware that his meetings with President Reagan were based more and more on formality and less on substance. Conversations that mattered were conducted outside the Oval Office, with U.S. officials like the Secretary of State, not with the president. It was as if Reagan was scripted. My husband was deeply concerned, because he had always had very direct relations with American presidents, but it was clear to my husband that in this last year of Reagan's presidency, his health had become an obstacle. Hussein's concern was reinforced by a phone call from the White House a month or so after the Intifada began. What was striking in that particular phone conversation was that after the initial hellos and pleasantries, Reagan went directly into a series of points and then started to say goodbye. When Hussein interjected a question, Reagan was totally thrown off, and the conversation abruptly ended. Listening to the playback, it seemed quite obvious that Reagan had been reading the points he was making from note cards and could not sustain any further discussion. Still, the conversation clearly had an impact. Shortly afterward, Philip Habib, Reagan's former special envoy to the Middle East, arrived in Jordan with the welcome news that the United States would now push with vigor for an international peace conference. The new U.S. position was a complete reversal of what the Secretary of State had told my husband just 3 months earlier. Although the Intifada succeeded in establishing an identity for the Palestinian people separate from the stereotype identity of the PLO, the uprising did not lead to a political solution. The United States and Israel still refused to negotiate with the PLO, and the PLO still refused to authorize my husband to speak for a joint delegation. Moreover, a new Palestinian leadership rising out of the Intifada on the West Bank was just as suspicious of Jordan as of the PLO. And in a March 1988 communique, called on the Palestinians in the Jordanian parliament to resign their seats and align with their people. The king was stung. Jordan had been supporting the West Bank since 1967, paying the salaries of teachers and civil servants in both the West Bank and Gaza, and maintaining the holy places in Jerusalem. No one had argued more forcefully or credibly on the world stage for a Palestinian homeland and the right of Palestinian self-determination, all the while resisting enormous pressure from the United States to make a separate peace with Israel. On July 31, 1988, 7 months into the Intifada, King Hussein severed Jordan's ties to the West Bank. He had decided it was the right moment for Palestinians to assume responsibility for managing their own affairs. His top aides had made a study of Jordan's relations with the Palestinians and recommended disengagement from the West Bank. "Let them have it," the king said to Abu Shakr, then commander-in-chief of the Jordanian army. "Let them carry the burden." He made it very clear, however, that disengagement with the West Bank did not include relinquishing Hashemite trusteeship of the holy places in Jerusalem. Hussein viewed this responsibility as a personal and spiritual obligation, as well as a political necessity, since there was no guarantee that the Israelis would allow the Palestinians sovereignty over those disputed sites. The Iran-Iraq War finally came to an end in August 1988. And in November, Arafat persuaded the Palestinian National Council to declare a Palestinian state in the occupied territories, with Jerusalem as its capital. Events moved rapidly after that. Now that there was no issue of West Bank representation, the Jordanian parliament was dissolved and restructured, and the country prepared for the first free general elections since 1967. We were able, during these demanding times, to enjoy rare, peaceful moments with all the children at Buckhurst Park, an English refuge that had come to us through the generosity of a group of Hussein's close friends. Here we had as much privacy as we ever would. We could lead a nearly normal family life, and the children began to think of it as a second home. Where Al-Nadwa was full of offices, Buckhurst was a quiet, cozy place to unwind. We would gather to talk or watch television in the sitting room, and sometimes roast chestnuts in the fireplace, a family ritual I introduced that dated back to my childhood winters in New York City. My husband enjoyed chestnuts, and the children would compete over who could peel them faster for him, leaving them all with slightly burned fingers. We could walk freely through the streets of nearby Windsor with the children, browse in the bookshops and music shops my husband loved, and have meals at the Waterside Inn and nearby restaurants. My husband loved impromptu softball games on the lawn at Buckhurst, in which everyone from the head of the Royal Squadron and the chief of protocol to the children and the gardeners would play. On June 15, Hussein left a beautiful 10th anniversary letter on my pillow at Buckhurst. "This is a very special time. This is a very special month, and a very special year," he wrote. "We are 10 years older, and 10 years old. We will never be 10 again, but with God's blessings we shall continue to grow and mature together all the more for many other years to come. Silver, gold, who can predict? I thank God for our life of love and the children we are blessed to have. I thank you for so much. I know it is not all I would have wished for you, or anything close to that. I know myself, I know my shortcomings, and I also know I am blessed to have you by my side, loving, caring, brave, and pure. All the finest things in life grow more valuable as they grow and mature. I hope the times to come will be better than those that have passed, and I treasure all the happiest of memories of our travel through time. For despite the fact that everything changes from time to time, and one drives down to start a hill climb, the balance, I feel, is in the realm of goodness, as together we climb through the years. This is a special time, a special month and year. I am ever proud of you as you stand by my side. I pray for God to bless you through the years and give us strength and courage, happiness, contentment, and the comfort of sharing and giving of our best. God bless our family, and many thanks to you for being you. The one God blessed me by bringing us together 10 years ago to start through life, a loving husband and his beloved wife. With you by my side, I celebrate each day. Happy 10th, and with God's blessings, many more to come. With all my love, Hussein. In England, Hussein pursued his vision of preserving Jordan's aviation heritage, and to that end he collected a number of old aircraft to form a historic flight for the Royal Jordanian Air Force. Among them was the Dove aircraft in which he had learned to fly, the very plane Syrian MiG fighters had tried to force down in the 1950s, as well as several Hawker Hunters that the Jordanian Air Force used in the 1967 war. These aircraft were displayed at air shows throughout the United Kingdom, the largest of which was the Royal International Air Tattoo, of which Hussein was a patron. In England, we also enjoyed time together in the helicopter my husband had been given as a present. By regulation, our pilot, Richard Verrill, was not supposed to let Hussein take the controls. But, of course, he did, and we spent some wonderful impromptu moments in the air. My husband also loved flying his fixed-wing official aircraft, particularly for the more challenging takeoffs and landings. He often flew the official TriStar into Brize Norton, a major RAF transport base, where Richard would meet him in the helicopter and fly him the 20 minutes or so to Buckhurst. Flying into Brize Norton was much easier than coming into Heathrow, which was usually backed up because of all the commercial air traffic, but the RAF had strict regulations. Richard loves to tell the story of one of my husband's arrivals at Brize Norton, preceded by a call to air traffic control requesting permission to do a flypast before landing. Permission was duly granted, along with a reminder of the strict requirement that he was not to fly below 400 feet. Richard, who was standing with the station commander when the call came in, knew what was coming. Being a hooligan, all he wanted to do was to rip down the runway at high speed and very low level, he told me. So he was not in the least surprised when the giant TriStar suddenly appeared just over the hedge, closer to 4 than 400 feet, and went roaring down the runway only to veer up very sharply. My husband then came back around, landed perfectly, and taxied in. Nothing was said at the time. But 2 weeks later, as the two men were helicoptering into the base, Richard received a call from the deputy station commander. "Would you bring His Majesty in?" After Hussein landed the helicopter, he was asked politely to step inside the station, where he was presented with a royal scolding and the irrefutable evidence of his transgression, a photograph of the TriStar skimming the runway at the height of the hedge, a photograph of which, Richard says, he was justly proud, no doubt. I would guess that the RAF understood, and certainly Richard understood, that every so often my husband had to let off some steam. I had one airborne adventure in England on my own. During a formal black tie event to benefit St. John's Ophthalmic Hospital in Jerusalem, I was persuaded by our host, Robert Pooley, to try out a hot air balloon. I clambered clumsily into the basket in my formal evening dress, and off we went, with the ever-present special branch officer at my side, soaring over the peaceful English landscape. It was the most extraordinary sensation, listening alternately to the roar of the gas jets heating the air to ascend, and to the utter silence when the jets shut off. My only previous experience with ballooning had been watching the film Around the World in 80 Days, and I found actual flight absolutely magical. We put down in a cow pasture next to a small farmhouse and knocked on the door to ask to use the phone to send for a car. That is fairly normal behavior for balloonists. You cannot necessarily turn around and go back to where you came from. But it must have come as a surprise to the residents of that house when two men in tails and the Queen of Jordan in formal evening dress appeared at their door. That exhilarating episode convinced me that ballooning might provide a unique perspective on Jordan's romantic landscapes. Shortly thereafter, I approached Richard Branson, the founder and chairman of Virgin Atlantic Airways and an avid balloonist, with my plan. At our invitation, Richard came out to Jordan with a mammoth Virgin Atlantic balloon and helped us explore the possibility of developing ballooning as an adventure tourism activity. I thought Wadi Rum, described by T.E. Lawrence as vast and echoing and godlike, would make a unique setting for ballooning. But when Richard arrived to test the conditions, the winds were fickle and erratic. After having to cancel several trial flights in Wadi Rum, Richard scheduled a liftoff for just after sunrise from Amman Airport and invited the children along. My husband, who was normally a late riser, was skeptical enough about the safety of balloon flight that we awoke at dawn to go with the children, and he returned an enthusiast. Hot air ballooning eventually did catch on in Jordan, even in Wadi Rum. Some years later, a major international ballooning event was held there to celebrate Hussein's birthday. It was an extraordinary sight to see so many colorful balloons from so many countries decorating the azure desert sky. Jordan was soon to be represented in cinematic splendor, and the circumstances behind that event were pure serendipity. In June 1988, my husband spirited me away for a stolen weekend in Scotland, back to Glen Eagles for the first time since our honeymoon. Our romantic return coincided with a charity celebrity shoot hosted by our friend Jackie Stewart, the legendary Formula One race car driver. It was there that we first met Steven Spielberg and Harrison Ford, who were filming Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade at Pinewood Studios outside of London. Harrison and his wife, Melissa Matheson, were already down the road neighbors in Wyoming, where my sister and I had a cabin, but I had not met Steven before. When he told me he was hoping to film part of the movie in Petra, I offered as much help as they needed to simplify any dealings with the bureaucracy or to facilitate arrangements. For a number of years, I had been trying to persuade Arnold Schwarzenegger, who was married to a dear friend, Maria Shriver, and other actors and directors to consider Jordan as a film location. Not only would it be a source of revenue for the country, but it would also provide invaluable exposure and good public relations. There could be no better promotion for Jordan than a George Lucas Steven Spielberg film shot in Petra. The day I took Ali, Hamza, Hashim, and Iman to Petra to see the Indiana Jones filming, they were starstruck by Harrison Ford and Sean Connery. And I was every bit as thrilled that the directors were very impressed and surprised by Jordan, and thought it one of the best locations they had ever worked in. My interest in the project generated an absurd story in a British tabloid, a detailed story about how I had had a torrid affair with Sean Connery during the filming in Petra, and how my husband had been so enraged that he had sent the royal guards to bring me back to the palace, but that I had refused. It was so outlandish that I laughed out loud. My husband, however, was not amused. He, who had always told me before to ignore it when my character was being slandered in the tabloids, promptly said, "Let's get hold of a libel lawyer. I think we should respond to this one." I agreed, knowing that in the Arab world, lies and character assassination are just part of the nasty cycle of gossip, but sexual innuendo about a man's wife involves his honor and is considered an altogether different order of magnitude. That unpleasantness aside, Indiana Jones was a great boon to Jordan, and we were encouraged to learn that Stephen was already thinking of filming another project in the country. He had been considering an epic film on Alexander the Great for a long time, Stephen told me, and perhaps a film on the Crusades. The conversation quickly turned to Wadi Rum and other possible locations in the country. As their filming came to an end, I arranged for Stephen and his colleagues to helicopter to Aqaba and make a slight detour up to Hussein's favorite Wadi Rum mountaintop, so they could see what an ethereal landscape they would have to work with if and when they decided to make the Alexander the Great film. Stephen and his crew were impressed, and I cannot say I was surprised. Wadi Rum was a location that never failed to stir the senses. One year I gave a birthday party for Hussein there, inviting family and a few close friends to share that occasion on a pink boulevard of sandy desert, rimmed by sheer lavender limestone cliffs and crags. As the guests mingled, the Bedouin tribesmen in the area, quite spontaneously, started marching toward our encampment in celebration of the king's birthday. The sound grew louder and louder as they emerged from the inky blackness of the desert night and approached our campfire, where my husband and his sons joined them in the traditional dance, debka, and guttural song. For one of my favorite parties for Hussein, I asked all his friends and family to attend in traditional Arab dress. Some of our friends, long accustomed to Western dress, had to hunt around for something appropriate for the occasion. But it was worth it. It was the most magnificent sight to see the men in robes and headdresses, and the women in their flowing, brightly colored, often richly embroidered caftans. In keeping with my wishes, we often celebrated my birthday in a more low-key fashion. August was blazing hot in Aqaba, and besides, there always seemed to be a crisis in our part of the world during the summer. In August 1988, I was looking forward to celebrating my 37th birthday, quietly, with my husband and our children, in Aqaba, when the phone rang during lunch. A woman I did not know very well was calling with a question about my birthday party. Birthday party? When I told her that there were no plans for a party, she insisted that there were. She had heard it from several people in Aqaba. "You know how people gossip around here," I told her. When I returned to the table, sputtering about gossips, I missed the guarded looks on the faces of my husband and several of my stepchildren. That evening Hussein asked if I would like to cruise down the coast with him in his boat, just the two of us. I readily accepted his invitation, and off we went, down the Red Sea toward the Saudi border. Then, without explanation, we veered off course, heading due west toward the Egyptian coast and picturesque Faroean Island, site of an ancient castle. Set off the coastline in a beautiful bay with stretches of golden beaches, the island is just beyond the northernmost point of the occupied Sinai, which had been returned to Egypt after Camp David. It was a gorgeous spot, and we had been going there ever since that territory had been returned. As we approached it in the darkness, suddenly the island burst into light, and I could see our children and dozens of family members and friends all standing there waving at us. I was speechless. Somehow, in the midst of all the political crises of the summer, Hussein had managed to pull off the most extraordinary birthday surprise. I could not believe so many of our friends had slipped into Aqaba and made their way to the island, and I did not have a clue. What an enchanting evening! With the permission of the local Egyptians, my husband had organized an extraordinary buffet dinner and entertainment on a rocky promontory at the base of the fortress, which had loomed majestically since the time of Salah ad-Din, one of the far-flung outposts of his empire. I felt blessed to be surrounded by so many people I loved, and I savored that memory for many years to come. Chapter 14. Growing Pains. Hussein and I were on a state visit to Washington, D.C., after the inauguration of President Bush in April 1989, when riots and demonstrations against the government broke out in Jordan. We were shocked by reports we were receiving from Amman and by news images of the turmoil in the southern towns of Ma'an, Tafila, and Kerak. Over the course of the next 4 days, the violence would even spread to the northern city of Salt. The rioters' actions were extreme, but the people's discontent was understandable. Several years earlier, the government had adopted measures to fix the ailing Jordanian economy. But by early 1989, the situation had worsened. The country was forced to turn for emergency help to the International Monetary Fund, IMF, which had insisted on draconian austerity measures. The day before we left for scheduled meetings in Washington, King Hussein had learned that the government was planning to raise fuel prices in the coming days to meet the demands of the IMF, and that the Prime Minister had failed to inform him that the central bank's reserves had dwindled to almost nothing. Jordanians were already suffering from the devaluation of the Jordanian dinar, a high unemployment rate, a drop in the standard of living, and a cut in government services. A sudden government decision to raise the price of fuel and other basic commodities, such as cigarettes, telephone services, electricity, and irrigation water, would be the last straw. I had begged my husband to appear on television before we left to explain to the Jordanian people the reason for the price increases. Explain the hikes so that people understand why belt-tightening measures are necessary. They need to know that you appreciate the extra hardship these measures will impose and that you will explore every possible way to lessen the burden. The king, however, was advised against addressing the nation, and there is no way of knowing whether doing so would have made the difference. Instead, we left for our first official visit to the United States in 3 years. Within 48 hours, demonstrations erupted in different parts of the country. We were kept abreast of every development at home, while Hussein carried on with his agenda to request political and military aid from the U.S. Congress, albeit with a heavy heart. George Bush was an old friend and very sympathetic to our position. Congress was less understanding. The king had always been regarded as a leader who could provide stability, and now Jordanians looked like they were joining the Intifada in the occupied territories, throwing stones and burning banks and government buildings. After Hussein's last engagement, we returned directly to Amman. The riots were quickly contained. What troubled me the most was the willful destruction of health clinics. I understood how some government buildings might become targets of a mob's wrath, but to purposefully destroy buildings essential to humanitarian services seemed so terribly self-defeating. I knew, as did many people around me, that the rise in prices and the resulting riots were indicative of a far larger national crisis in the country. Through my own work, I had seen mounting anger and frustration among our people over what they viewed as a lack of responsiveness to their economic hardships, criticism of the government's autocratic policies, especially restrictions of freedom of expression, had boiled over. There were also charges of widespread corruption. My husband had been only partly apprised of the full extent of the malaise, and now he was criticized for being out of touch. In a sense, this was true. His focus on the search for peace and on mobilizing international support for his impoverished nation had consumed most of his time and energy, and he had not been actively monitoring the government, which was responsible for the day-to-day running of the country. The king acted very quickly in the wake of the disturbances. Within a day of our return to Jordan, he accepted the resignation of the prime minister and his government, and appointed a new interim government headed by Hussein's trusted and progressive cousin, Sharif Zayed bin Shaker. Together they forged a blueprint for democratic reforms. Hussein accelerated preparations for the first general parliamentary elections to be held in 22 years, and the new prime minister lifted martial law and began a process that would ease restrictions on the press. The king announced these changes in a forceful and emphatic speech to the nation. While we were still in Washington, one opposition group had spread several outrageous rumors accusing me of spending obscene amounts of money on designer clothes and expensive jewelry. That snowballed from my alleged purchase of a ring for $5,000 to buying that same ring for $1 million. Then ballooned from a ring to a brooch to a necklace to a whole suite of jewelry for $20 million. Whoever was responsible for the rumor even circulated a supposed photocopy of the check I had written to the jeweler. This, of course, legitimized the gossip, because people could say, "We saw the check," although no one was ever able to produce a copy. I was very upset. For years I had been advocating basic democratic reforms, demands that were at the heart of the unrest, and yet now I was serving as a lightning rod for anger toward the government. I had seen the same pattern played out in other countries and knew that this particular slander was political rather than personal. But at the same time, I was not used to being targeted politically in such an unstable situation. One wild charge followed another, including the ludicrous report in a U.S. newspaper that my husband had sired an illegitimate child, a dwarf, whom he kept hidden away in America. My husband dismissed all the stories as just one more smear campaign against him. Nonetheless, I remember vividly going down to Aqaba for the weekend with some of the children at the height of the rumors, and feeling truly uncomfortable driving through town to our home, too timid to smile at anyone. What are they thinking? I wondered. Has everyone heard the story of the check, and do they believe it? Could the slander have damaged my relationship with the people who had inspired and motivated me all these years? My stomach was churning with anxiety when I summoned the courage to find out a few days later. I had no idea what to expect on my first visit to one of our villages as the riots abated. I drove myself in my jeep, as I always did. Hundreds of people rushed out to the road to greet me, waving and calling my name. When I arrived at the village, it was as if nothing had happened. Looking at the crowd of welcoming faces, I felt that the weight of the world had been lifted from my shoulders. As they always do, the rumors subsided, as it became apparent that they had no substance. Hussein and I tried to modify our official duties as much as possible after the riots, postponing or canceling most of our scheduled official visits abroad. We knew that during such difficult times, Jordanians needed the reassuring physical presence of their leader. While we curtailed our own international travel, it was more important than ever to continue developing bilateral economic, social, and cultural relations with other countries. We appreciated the decision of Sweden to go ahead with the planned state visit of King Carl Gustaf and Queen Silvia, despite what we had just been through. Protocol dictated that full ceremonial dress be worn during official visits by royal families, but the Swedish monarchs were scheduled to visit Jordan only months after the riots, and I did not think such a display would be appropriate. I called Silvia, a particularly thoughtful and wise friend, and asked her if she would be comfortable breaking with the more formal Swedish tradition by not wearing a tiara on this occasion. Silvia was very understanding, and we agreed to compromise by wearing simple ornaments in our hair, which satisfied their needs and was more appropriate for us. Around that time, we also welcomed Sheikha Fatima, the wife of Sheikh Zayed, the ruler of Abu Dhabi. She is another remarkable first lady, having pioneered adult literacy and equal job opportunity for women in the United Arab Emirates. She and her husband were also deeply committed to protecting the environment, and they contributed generously to Jordanian charities. Abu Dhabi is a very conservative country, however, which posed challenges for Sheikha Fatima's four-day visit, the first ever to Jordan for a Gulf First Lady. Because of their conservative custom of separating men and women, Sheikha Fatima arrived with a heavily veiled all-woman retinue. The historic visit had to remain ladies only. Even our household staff had to be all female. Fortunately, we had women members of our police force and army available to provide security for Sheikha Fatima and her retinue during her official program in Jordan. I traveled to Iraq in the spring of 1989 to visit Saddam Hussein's wife and cousin, Sajida. I had delayed the trip for some time, despite the government's urging that I accept the long-standing invitation, but I finally seized the opportunity just before our official trip to Washington, D.C. It proved to be a fascinating experience. In ancient times, Iraq was the cradle of civilization, a center for intellectual ferment and discovery. In 4000 B.C., under the Sumerians, early calendars were first used, and the first written alphabet was invented. In Babylon, some 50 miles south of the capital, King Hammurabi inscribed his famous code of laws on massive stones in the 18th century B.C. In the 10th century B.C., Baghdad was a great center of learning that attracted a dynamic mix of scientists, poets, philosophers, and intellectuals. Some 4 centuries later, the great King Nebuchadnezzar II built the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. This rich heritage remained a significant part of Iraqi culture. but there was a new political overlay in the country's contemporary art that I found deeply disturbing. When I was taken to the National Art Gallery, most of the art I saw was dedicated to the glory of Saddam Hussein. Perhaps it was the result of the Iran-Iraq War, which no doubt put a damper on creative expression, but the art reminded me of German World War II propaganda. It was a visit to a kindergarten in Baghdad, however, that affected me most. The extent to which those very young children were being taught to idolize their leader was deeply unsettling. In Jordan, the king certainly inspired a personality cult of sorts, a phenomenon not unique to our region, but what I saw in Iraq was extreme. Rather than promoting a sense of national identity, the state was indoctrinating children to view their country through the persona of a single, all-powerful leader. The Iraqi people's reaction to my visit also surprised me. I was taken to the center of Baghdad to visit a monument erected to martyrs lost in war, where I was welcomed effusively by the mayor and by all the people with whom I came in contact. The warmth and excitement in the crowds that spontaneously collected around me in different parts of the city amazed me as well. I knew it was not simply my presence that elicited this emotional response, but the affection the Iraqi people felt for King Hussein. Still, I was deeply moved by the outpouring of emotion. When I returned to Jordan after the 3-day visit, I told my husband about the extreme cult of personality I had witnessed. For the Iraqi people to have no other choice but to focus all their hopes and dreams on a single person seemed to me to represent an unsustainable future for the country. Saddam Hussein would not always be Iraq's leader, and it was important that generations of young people developed loyalty to the country or its institutions, not simply to one individual. Summer came, and school let out. I had taken to sending the children to stay with my sister in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, for at least part of their summer holidays, to get them out of the royal cocoon, as I often described it. I wanted them to experience the real world, and look after themselves without security personnel, household staff, and retainers of any sort. I kept hoping that we would all be able to get away together as a family, but sadly, a summer vacation together usually eluded us. When the children returned in August for a quiet birthday dinner for me on the beach in Aqaba, they were full of news about their summer holiday, especially Iman, who had succeeded in becoming the youngest rock climber ever in that region of Wyoming. She had also become a super fisherwoman, to the boys' initial dismay. Hamza and Hashim loved to fish, and apparently they had not expected Iman to take to it so naturally and so successfully. Once home, however, the boys regaled us with proud stories of her accomplishments. We were preparing for a historic event on November 8, 1989, the first general elections since 1967. There was a festive air in many of the villages and cities I visited, as young men who had been throwing stones 6 months earlier hoisted political banners and posters. Candidates for office were running as individuals, because, since the destabilizing regional turmoil of the late 1950s, political parties had been banned. The only organized and well-funded political group was the Muslim Brotherhood, which was registered as a charitable society in Jordan. It was the first time Jordanian women had been able to exercise their right to vote in a general election since they had been enfranchised in 1974. And on the morning of the election I was heartened to see so many women at the polls. Quite a few were running for office themselves, though none would win their races. It was the candidates from the Muslim Brotherhood and their allies who would be the biggest winners, gaining enough seats to form roughly 1/3 of the parliament. There was alarm in some quarters at the political success of the Islamists. There were even pronouncements in establishment circles in Amman that King Hussein would dissolve parliament after the election, because neither he nor his ministers would want to deal with opposing views. However, the king was wise enough to appreciate the purpose served by the election of the Islamists. They were now part of the very government they had been challenging. "They have been living on slogans," my husband told me. "Now they are going to have to deliver results." the king also appreciated the positive role the Islamists could play in Jordan. While they emphasized their conservative social agenda, to the dismay of many in urban centers of the country, the Islamists participated in the democratic process and voiced their opinions, part and parcel of the political fabric of the society. Over the years, they have adopted a consistent and usually conservative social posture in Parliament, and they have been allies to the government in many difficult times. Despite the occasional bumps in the road, Jordan's Islamists have been a compelling example of the value of inclusion. For me, the importance of this day was that Jordan had the self-confidence to risk dissent by opening up debate, not closing it down. By holding democratic elections, free and fair, Jordan was setting yet another example in a region that badly needed participatory decision-making. No one knew at the time where this would lead, but it was the beginning of a process that many of us felt was absolutely vital and necessary. As we drove to the historic opening of the Jordanian Parliament on November 29, my thoughts were focused less on the Islamist presence than they were on the political advances women had made, however slim. Though the Muslim Brotherhood and others may consider their presence in larger numbers the great significance of the occasion, I noted in my diary, for me, it is Leila's presence as the first woman ever to take a seat in the Parliament's appointed Senate. King Hussein moved forward determinedly toward a more democratic system of government. He lifted martial law, pledged a freer press, and publicly acknowledged the existence of forces in the society that were not necessarily in agreement with each other or with him. He invited them to debate the state of the country and to put together a new national charter to reflect all shades of the political spectrum, forming a new basis from which the country could move forward. In the end, everybody was represented. The national charter extended the rights of women, defined new policies on the free flow of information, resolved the stance Jordan would take on the Palestinian question, and clarified the relationship between the monarchy and the democratic parliament. Because Jordanians were so excited about the reactivation and strengthening of the constitution, almost everybody was willing to compromise. And the compromise came mostly from the socially conservative, who were the single biggest elected bloc in Parliament. From that time on, my husband's goal was to strengthen the democratic institutions in Jordan, and in so doing to reduce the natural tendencies in such a traditional society to depend on him as their Sayyidna, or Lord. "I do not want this country to crumble when I am gone," he often said. "Every time there is a problem, the feeling is Sayyidna can solve it." Well, Sayyidna cannot solve it alone anymore. Everyone has to participate. It would take time, of course, to develop those institutions, especially in a society that was so used to depending on its king, but the historic events of 1989 were a good beginning. "We are on the crest of a new wave of anti-autocratic ideology," I wrote in my journal. "Let us pray we ride it to safety in a new society, dynamic and committed." I had no idea how soon that new society would be put to the test. Chapter 15. Prelude to War. Looking back now, as I try to recreate the larger context of the 1990 to 1991 Persian Gulf crisis, I can find harbingers of trouble as far back as 1977. When I first visited Iraq to gather information on their airline facilities and training requirements for the Pan-Arab Aviation University project. Saddam Hussein was not yet in power. He would become the country's ruler in 1979. But there was already a palpable climate of fear. It was considered unsafe to discuss anything but the most innocuous subjects. Foreign business representatives or diplomats would feel under tables for listening devices. Iraqis simply assumed they were there. The Iraqi officials I met with at the airport for my research refused to disclose anything about their commercial aviation operations. The number of regularly scheduled flights was treated like a state secret, even though it was a matter of international public record. 12 years later, in the spring of 1989, we observed with concern Saddam Hussein's rhetoric at the February 1989 meeting of the Arab Cooperation Council, formed the year before by Jordan, Egypt, Yemen, and Iraq. Saddam Hussein was increasingly bellicose toward Israel and the United States, stirring confrontational passions when he proclaimed that there was no place in Arab ranks for those who submit to the will of the superpower, America. The U.S. Congress responded by cutting off wheat sales to Iraq. Much of the Middle East interpreted Saddam Hussein's fiery rhetoric as a bid for regional leadership, more than a genuine attack on Israel and Washington. And increasingly, Palestinians were beginning to feel that Saddam might be the one to finally liberate their homeland, a hope that was becoming desperate in light of the swelling number of settlements in the occupied territories. Soviet Jews started flooding into Israel at the beginning of 1990, having finally been allowed to leave the Soviet Union at the end of the Cold War. The flow of immigrants was staggering. Many had applied for visas to the United States, but with a quota system in place there, the vast majority went to Israel. And this influx was of enormous concern to my husband and other Arab leaders. They were arriving at the rate of some 1,400 a week, and being settled in the occupied territories in violation of the Geneva Conventions. By the summer of 1991, there would be more than 100,000 settlers in the occupied territories, plus another 127,000 in East Jerusalem, once again seriously altering the situation on the ground. Against the backdrop of the deteriorating situation in Israel, King Hussein's frustration grew. There seemed to be nothing he could do to restart the stalled peace process, and little he could do to stem Jordan's economic crisis. He traveled to Saudi Arabia in the middle of February to discuss the country's dire economic forecast and his regional political concerns, but King Fahd was not very receptive. Amid this stalemate came an incident that would heighten tensions for Saddam in the West. Farzad Bazoft, a British journalist from the Observer newspaper, was arrested in Iraq, charged with espionage, and sentenced to death. Many in the region speculated that the Iranian-born journalist might very well have been a spy, but the British government insisted on his innocence and called for clemency. King Hussein telephoned the Iraqi president several times to try to talk him out of executing the journalist, warning that it would be playing right into the hands of those who were looking for an excuse to attack him. Saddam, however, was not about to give in to demands from the West. On March 15, 1990, we received word that the journalist had been hanged. The British outcry against Saddam Hussein was long and sustained. Members of Parliament officially expressed their total revulsion at Iraq's unspeakable brutality and called the execution an act of calculated violence by a blood-stained dictatorship. Margaret Thatcher, Britain's prime minister, was particularly incensed at Saddam Hussein for denying her personal appeal for the journalist's life, and she became increasingly wary of the Iraqi leader. On March 22, in the midst of the growing turmoil in the region, the U.S. Senate inexplicably passed a resolution that Jerusalem must remain an undivided city. Though the resolution did not go so far as to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, it was taken as such on Arab streets. And as yet another provocative move by the United States, in this case to undermine Muslim claims on the holy city. Under international law, Arab East Jerusalem, having been taken by force, was and is an occupied city within the occupied territories and subject to UN Security Council Resolution 242's call for the withdrawal of occupying forces. The Senate resolution was strongly denounced a week later at a meeting of the Arab nations, inflaming the growing anti-Americanism on the streets. My husband was discouraged by the apparent lack of interest on the part of the United States in seeking a solution. "Nothing seems to change," he told me. "The openings are not there." Hussein felt somewhat better when he made the Umrah pilgrimage to Mecca and a visit to Medina in April, As was the custom, many male family members accompanied my husband, including his sons, Princes Faisal and Hamza, and his nephew, Prince Talal, who kept Hamza close by them to keep him from being trampled. Hamza was 10 at the time, and so small he had to have his white, seamless pilgrimage robes made especially for him. Hamza looked like a little angel, Talal told me. Hamza's first umrah turned out to be quite an adventure for him. The men prayed at Prophet Muhammad's tomb in Medina, and then at the tomb of Hamza's namesake. At dinner with King Fahd, Hamza was evidently enjoying himself enormously, chatting away with the two elderly Saudi princes he was seated between, and holding his own with King Fahd himself. "Bring him back, and we'll find him a Saudi bride," King Fahd told my husband. Hamza understood the king's proposal to mean he might have to marry right away, which put a brief damper on his otherwise exciting trip with his father. Malaise was spreading over the region, and particularly in Jordan. Without some catalyst of significant proportion, I feared we were deteriorating into a cycle of violence that would perpetuate the instability that had affected the region for generations. I was also painfully aware of the pattern, observed by political analysts, that the Middle East suffered a major explosion every decade or so, and in the 11 years I had been married to my husband there had been no war. There were certainly violent flare-ups. In May 1990,